This is January 25th, 1985, and this is the second interview with Mr. L. David Ash, longtime Ford designer.
Okay, we're live, eh? Okay, last time we met, we were talking about the 57 Ford, which chronologically would have been calendar year about 1955. Shortly after that, I was transferred again, and this time to the Lincoln Studio, which was a place I hadn't previously been, and it had a new chief stylist named John Najar. And the the major project at hand was the all-new Lincoln Continental, Lincoln and Continental, and also finishing up the facelift of the 57 Lincoln, which Bill Schmidt hadn't quite completed before he left for Packard. Well, the 58 Lincoln was quite a car. I noticed in some publications it's called a slant-eyed monster. It was a monster, all right, in size. It was the longest car I think I've ever seen, at least as a standard production vehicle. It was also controversial in its engineering aspects because it was not body on frame as is customary practice, but the new unitized concept where the body and frame are integrated into one structural assembly. To further complicate matters, the car was to be built in an all-new assembly plant at Wixom, which had never been used before. The combination of all of these factors resulted in a vehicle that was not terribly satisfactory from a number of points of view. However, it certainly was impressive looking. One of its interesting derivatives was another Continental. This was the Continental that superseded the demise of the Mark II, which was produced by the Continental Division. This Continental was strictly a minor modification of a 58 Lincoln, and it bore the designation Mark III. More about that later.
Dave, may we move you back to the days of the 58 and the 57 and the Mark III?
Yeah.
The atmosphere had changed. The Mark II program had been given the deep six by this time.
Yes,
the Continental program.
Actually, there was, I believe, a model year 57 Continental Mark II. I remember I inherited it because the division was disbanded by then, and it merely had to do with releasing, I think, some additional or changed colors on it. Very few were probably built, but it was the Mark II. And of course, at that time, the Edsel was rearing its head. And the Ford management, I guess, in an effort to set itself up as a parallel to General Motors, had established separate divisions for each of its car lines. There was a Ford division, a Mercury division, a Edsel division, a Lincoln division, and a Continental division. Very unwieldy situation.
Yes.
Especially when you got into the trim and color aspects of it, because each one of those divisions had its own assortment of colors. We had probably five or six different whites, for instance, ranging from cool ones to ivory-colored ones and so forth, and a variety of reds and blues, and it was terrible, really.
So you weren't doing much interchanging?
There wasn't really any.
There wasn't any?
There was interchangeability in the cars. For instance, the Edsel was derived from the Ford, 57 Ford, and in its bigger series from the Mercury. But the Continental, of course, by the Mark II was entirely individual by itself. But the interiors and the colors were all distinct and separate. I think the only one they shared probably was black, because nobody knew how to make a light black or whatever, you understand? So it was a strange time.
Unwieldy, you said, is a good phrase.
Unwieldy, yes.
And someone obviously realized that very quickly.
Unwieldy. Oh, yes. Well, the first thing that happened was the Continental Division died. The car and the division died entirely. The next thing, the Edsel died. And a strange three-headed division was created called MEL, Mercury, Edsel, Lincoln, which lasted for a very short time.
Headed up by the ineffable John J. Nance at one point.
Yes, Jungle Jim. He was something else. Henry Ford had a penchant for bringing in oddballs from the demise of other companies. This was Packard. Nance was one of the worst automotive executives I've ever come in contact with. For no other reason was that he didn't know anything about cars. He couldn't even drive a car.
Really?
Fortunately, he didn't last long. That was something else.
In terms of the design center, were you able to, for the personnel who were displaced by these amalgamations and cancellations, were they placed elsewhere?
For the most part, as far as I know, they were. People from the Continental Division, I think Bob Thomas and his designers came back into the design center and were assimilated. John Reinhardt, I believe, took a position with U.S. Steel as their designer. When the Edsel folded, all of those designers were absorbed, and some of the more important people, like Roy Brown, were exiled to England or elsewhere.
Right.
Get them out of sight for a while. Yeah. That's a sad thing in a way, because they did their best, and I think they did a fine-looking, unique car.
That was the procedure in those days, wasn't it? If you failed on an important procedure, you had exile.
I don't know. The first time I ever experienced it, you see, was there apparently was no disgrace connected with the demise of the Continental. It just was a car out of joint with its time. Of course, so was the Edsel. But the Edsel got such a black eye from the press and everybody that no one would... I know they put one in George Walker's parking spot on introduction day, and he refused to drive it. In fact, he wouldn't even talk about the car. He wouldn't, you know. If you talked to him about the Edsel, he just... start talking about something else, you know. He didn't.
And yet, Roy Brown worked for him, and it's
affected him. That's right, yeah. Absolutely. No, the thing, it just became a terrible embarrassment for everybody, all the way up and down.
Do you remember any, I remember seeing the, I worked for the Edsel Division very briefly in the summer of 56, and I remember seeing the final mock-up, and being naive as I was then, I thought it was beautiful. But do you remember any differences of opinion among your fellow designers about Roy's, not Roy's, but about the final Edsel design? And
I don't recall any adverse comments about it from designers in the other studios. I know eventually I had working for me Ken Spencer, who was under Roy Brown, the Edsel exterior designer. And he had a sort of hide around for a while. He was never, you know, shipped off anywhere. But and there was no onus on him, really, except for what he thought he had on him. I mean, I guess he felt that nobody liked him because nobody liked the car. Took him a long time to recover from the trauma of that design experience.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the guy's a crackerjack designer, and I was always glad to get him. A little grumpy and hard to get along with, but...
But he delivered the goods.
No problem, yeah.
Good.
No, I owned an Edsel myself.
Did you really?
That was before they had the lease car program. I bought one with my own money.
Wow.
And I liked it very much.
It seemed really gorgeous to me.
Yeah, I had no problem with it, but I think the press killed it. The other thing they did wrong was they made too damn many models of it. They didn't need all. They didn't need two complete lineups: one Ford Derived, one Mercury, and a two series within each one of them, and a full line from two doors to four doors, hard tops, convertibles, and station wagons. I mean, they went way overboard on their investment.
And I suspect another mistake was to institute a separate dealership organization.
Well, I don't know. When you got a full-fledged car division, you want to have a dealer organization.
Apparently Larry Doyle insisted on this.
Well, I don't know. he was what, Mercury?
No, he was the Edsel sales manager.
Okay, because I know Dick Craffey was the general manager.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's what they had to do, and that's what they did. But it was a very, very unfortunate decision on the part of the company. Mm-hmm. But I guess it didn't hurt too bad. Well, let's see, I talked about the 58 Lincoln and the Continental Mark III. Now, later on, there was to be another Continental Mark III, which we'll get into.
At this point, you had the Mark III in 58, you had the Mark IV in 59, and the Mark V in 1960.
That is correct.
But those were largely merchandising labels, weren't they?
They were names that were on the car.
Yeah, true.
And those things that were called Continental Mark III, IV, and V had the Continental Star on their hood, which originated with the John Reinhardt design group on the original Continental. Mm-hmm. They said Continental on them, and they carried the star.
Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, they weren't considered real Continentals, really.
Collectors don't consider them as such. Mm-hmm. And when we came much later on to the what turned out to be the Mark III Continental, Maya Koch and others completely abjured the existence of these 58, 59, and 60s.
Rewrote history,
as it were, which is probably just as well. But,
but they were sort of hybrids, weren't they?
They were merely derivative models.
That's better.
They carried, I don't think, any real distinctive sheet metal at all. Some touches on the interior and the name and the star and whatnot, and that was about it. So I moved around quite a bit in those days,
Exciting?
I found it very exciting, and I always welcomed it because it gave me different experiences in different studios and different projects. Shortly after the Lincoln experience, I was back in the Advance studio with Bob McGuire.
Now, he was a pretty well-spoken of individual by most of you.
Yes, I think you'll find that anyone that had been with Ford Design for a while would speak of McGuire with great respect and appreciation. He was...
Sort of special attributes did he have?
Yeah, he was, I would say, my mentor. He was a hard man to get to know. He came from GM, and he was in that little studio with Bourdonnais when I first came into Ford, and they were doing that spooky Lincoln. Incidentally, I found a sketch of it in Bob Thomas's book here. This is that Continental that I found in the Ford design office when I first came in.
Uh-huh.
That was a spooky looking car, and that always stuck in my mind, and that's, I think, where I derived this effect, which I eventually put on the Mustang, that side scoop.
Very good.
That must have stuck in my mind.
I wonder what happened to that.
Oh, it got junked eventually, because you can't keep those things around, and it was before the days of fiberglass, so it just sat there as it was clay, and it was painted, and it looked gorgeous, but it wasn't very durable, and nobody bought it. Anyway, I was back in the Ford in the Advance studio with Bob McGuire, and with a strange title. I was called Executive Stylist, Fashion Trends, and Special Assignments. Boy, that's a real catch-all. I mean, that's a license to do almost anything. So I said to Bob, I said, what's this fashion trends part of it? Well, he said, he said, you're supposed to seek out the trend of fabrics and colors in high fashion and home decorating as they might apply to and influence automotive colors, fabrics, and so forth. And I gulped that down and I said, oh, yeah? I said, how do I go about this and, you know, what do I produce? You know, I'm used to producing a clay model or something eventually in hard form for people to approve. Mm-hmm. Well, he says, I don't know what you're going to produce. He says, we'll play it by ear. That was one of his favorite phrases for a while. He says, in the meantime, you're going to have some expert advice. He said, the J. Walter Thompson, which was Ford Advertising Agency, it still is going to connect you up with Virginia Van Brunt, who is their fashion coordinator and consultant and one of their employees. And through her, you will have entree to others in the fashion world. I said, well, that's a step forward. Well, it turned out to be extremely interesting because I don't know whose idea this was. I suspect it came from very top management because from time to time they would grumble, Henry Ford and Breach, others, about our colors, you know. What's wrong with your colors? They don't look right. That's very helpful, you know. A color doesn't look right. Well, it looks all right to me. Of course, I never said that. But anyway, somebody up there decided that we ought to, you know, plumb the depths of where the real stuff came from, the fashion world. So, okay. So I went pouncing off to New York and met with Virginia, and she introduced me to the editor of Harper's Bazaar. She set up a luncheon meeting for me with Christian Dior. I forget all the other people I met, but it was all very interesting, but I still couldn't, you know, put my hand on something. I had been given license, if I wanted to have somebody create a car. For instance, I proposed to Dior that he might want to decorate one of our cars. Mm-hmm. Yes, he said, that would be fine. I said, well, there will be a suitable fee. I don't know what it is. Nobody ever told me, you know, how far out in the limb I could go.
What year was this, by the way?
Oh, I find it hard to put my thumb on it. It must have been around 58.
Okay.
Around there, I would say. 57, 58.
It's quite unusual.
Yes.
For that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to do it in brass and gold and red plush velvet and so forth. And I, you know, nodded my head to that sounded great, and I never did carry it any further. He went back to France and died, and I went back to Ford and got involved in other aspects of this. Well, all this went on for a while. In the meantime, I was doing my other part of the job, which was special assignments. That was at a more concrete basis. For instance, I was given the studio in the Edsel building, which was where the former Continental Mark II was designed, a very nice little facility, and down the road from the main design center and kind of out of the way. Nobody bothered me. In fact, I had to drag people over there to show them anything. It was really nice, and of course, at that time, it was the Edsel headquarters. Mm-hmm. Edsel was still still alive then. Maybe it was 56, I'm not really sure, 56, 57. I know the Edsel was still going on in there. So I was also told to hire a fabric designer and weaver. Yeah, I don't know where I found Helen Vincent, but I employed her and she wanted a hand loom. I mean, this was the farthest out part of my life. Almost. So anyway, I moved into this nice little studio, and it was in the Edsel building. and there was a balcony in it. I put Helen up there with her hand loom and all of her yarns and things and told her to weave. And she said, well, what would you like? I said, you know, that's about what I said. Well, I said, are you familiar with automotive fabrics? No. She says, are they wool? I said, I don't think so. And, well, we did some consulting with the trim and color department as to what we might have or do that could eventually, hopefully, turn out useful, because what she did on a hand loom, if it ever got any interest in it, would have to be translated into commercial weaving techniques and pass all sorts of god-awful tests, you know, for abrasion, soiling, and all that stuff. As a matter of fact, as it turned out, she actually did weave one fabric, which got approved and went into the production system and survived that and wound up in a Lincoln. Only one. But she kept busy up there for a while. Now, meanwhile, down on the floor, I was involved in a show car. The most exciting one I ever had anything to do with, although I don't have any pictures of it. It was called La Galaxie, spelled in French. I don't know whether you have anything in your files on it, but it was a very spooky car.
Yes, we do.
You know? It was the last, I think, of the fantasy show cars that I ever did that was spooky and far out. And we had, on the wall of the studio, we had a full-size outline drawing of it while the clay model was in progress. And I had assigned to me a young MIT graduate engineer by the name of Dick Noe. And he was supposed to actually sort of quasi-engineer this thing so that it had some sense of realism. McGuire told him he wanted a nuclear power plant in it. This was, you know, the atomics were just coming on strong now. And Noe said, a nuclear power plant? Yeah, that's right. Put it in the back. So with that in mind, I created these enormous blast tubes in the rear end, which I suppose were to let out the nuclear exhaust into the general atmosphere. Oh, boy. Anyway, it was a striking car, if I do say so myself. And one day McGuire came over. He didn't come over too often. He liked me to come over to his place. He came down the road and dropped in on us. He said, said to Noy, well, he says, where's the atomic engine? So Noy took him over to this full-size outline drawing, and there was a red rectangle. He says, there it is. McGuire, I guess, expected to see a whole bunch of, you know, tubes and dials and things that glowed and pulsed and whatever. He says, that's it? Yeah. He says, that's the smallest one I could get. And no, he was putting them on. He says, that's the smallest one I could put in there. Yeah.
Did Frank finally tumble, or was he?
Huh?
Did Frank finally tumble that his leg was being pulled?
Oh, you mean Bob McGuire?
I mean Bob, yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't think so. Well, he said, what is that rectangle? He says, that's the lead shielding on the outside of it. Oh, okay. So he said, obviously you can't see what's inside because it's all shielded. It has to be shielded. Okay.
How do you spell your associate's name? Noe, did you say?
N-O-E. Noe.
What was his first name?
Dick.
Dick Noe, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Whoops. We're talking about La Galaxie. Show car here, which was done in the little studio of the what was then the Edsel building. It was done full size in clay over a period of probably about 3 months. I don't really know what purpose it had, other than it was an assignment I had to do an advanced spooky car as far out as I could conceive without being too crazy. the car had a very unique aspect to it. The greenhouse was quite different, and also the so-called C-pillar, the back end of the roof line viewed from the side, had a unique scallop in it. The car, when in its final form, or the model in its final form, was to have supposedly incorporated a nuclear power device for propelling it. And some of the thematic material on the model reflects the supposed requirements for such a device, putting the enormous exhaust tubes on the rear end of the car. We conceived a unique symbol or device to identify the car. It was an ellipse with a flattened X going through it. This motif showed up on the front fender ends and also in the rear end of the vehicle. Along the side was a very distinctive bumper extension line with a very large sunken area of textured chrome-plated metal, which served to take air into the propulsion system. Among some of the other unique items that the vehicle had was chrome sidewall tires, and an extremely unique front lighting system.
Unique in what way?
Well, it had super beam headlamps on either side and a supplementary linear lighting system between them.
That was unique.
Yeah. The model developed in clay over a period of time, and we also did an interior buck for it where we did a special instrument panel. You ought to try and get a photograph of that too, because we had these what we called Sputnik instruments. They were floating transparent spheres with the indicators in them, and they sort of hovered in a concave area. Now, everything was very spooky.
How were they suspended?
Anti-gravs.
Ah.
How else?
I thought you might have suspended it in liquid.
No, they were just there.
Okay.
They were actually supported at the back, but where they sat out from this central area, but you couldn't see the support, so they looked like they were just floating there. Yes, well, I don't know what brought about the decision to cast the clay and make it into a show car.
Would McGuire had to have made that?
I don't know.
Decision?
He came over and he and I eventually approved the thing. You know, I got to a stage where I said, I think I'm done with it. What do we do with it now? So he came over and he looked at it, and we walked around it and thought that it was a very striking model, and that something ought to be done with it. I guess he got Walker involved in it, certainly, although I don't think George had seen it up to that time, and he thought it was great. And I don't know where it went from then, and which division sponsored it, whether it was Lincoln Mercury or Ford, probably Ford division. Ford eventually picked up the name Galaxy. It originated here. So it was decided by somebody with money, one of the divisions, to fabricate it and make a show car out of it for the show car circuits. So it was shipped over to the main design center to be cast, where it caused quite a furore, because nobody had seen it up to this time. And there wasn't anything like it going on anywhere in those studios. And when it got completed and rolled out of the shop, all done in pearlescent gold, and these blast tubes in the rear end had spooky lighting in them, where the outer area of the tubes glowed a sort of a fiery red in it, and it got, as it went inside, it got whiter and more violet colored as it got closer to the reactor core. It was a terribly spooky car. Mm. We had lights, you know, everywhere that worked.
Mm.
And the instruments were lit, and everything was just terribly spooky.
You elicited an awful lot of comment, I suspect.
Yes, it did. Yeah, when he got rolled out into the main hallway of the design center, people looked at it with their mouths agape. It was something, all right. That was about as far as a field as I ever got.
You remember Bourdonnais' comment, what he said about it?
No, I don't. He wasn't in charge of the place at that time.
That's
he
right.
was.
Yeah.
I guess he was the Mercury chief stylist.
That's right, he was. But yeah. Walker did like it.
Yeah.
This is January 25th, 1985, and this is Dave Crippen speaking today with L. David Ash, well-known, long-time Ford executive stylist, and this is Side 2.
Okay. Well, in line with the generally kooky assignments that I had at this time, somebody thought it would be a good idea to see if we could reduce the cost of doing conventional show cars. Well, now, a conventional show car is a modified production car as opposed to a concept thing like La Galaxy or the Mystère or the Atmos.
Mm-hmm.
So these are production cars that are taken and special things are designed for them, and then they're contracted out to somebody to fabricate and paint and finish under the supervision of the design center.
Oh, they weren't done entirely in the design center?
No. We tried to do it from time to time, but it took up too much capacity.
Mm-hmm.
The fabrication services in the design center were for fabrication of design material and properties, and they just could not take on show cars.
Mm-hmm. What sort of an organization would you ship it to?
Well, there were several in the area. One of them was Dearborn Steel Tubing.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the names of the others just offhand.
But that was the primary contract.
Sometimes they were out of state. But I never got involved in money. I never discussed money with these contractors. That was taken care of by the Lincoln Mercury Division or the Ford Division or whatever. So the only thing I did was furnish them with photographs, drawings, and information and supervision of what they were doing. And it worked all right, but I guess it was quite costly.
Mm.
So I was commissioned, along with a couple of other people, to go out to the West Coast and check in on the capacity of what were then called the customizers,
mm-hmm.
of which the West Coast used to have quite a number of them. One of the guys on his team was Jim Capolongo, who eventually rose in the company and became president of Ford of England. And another chap that we had with us was Harry Miller of the Lincoln Mercury Division. He was to represent the business aspect of having these people contract to do show cars.
What was Capolongo's?
Capolongo was with the Ford Division, and he was on his way up. When I first met him, he had just come in from Chrysler,
mm-hmm.
and he was a cost analyst. And I think he might have been in that capacity, you know, because he was going to, review the costs associated with these projects. He had not made much of a step upward at that time. But he did, you know, he went gradually up. He became one of Iacocca's boys and became a vice president and eventually president of Port of England.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, the three of us went out there and we interviewed three of these customizers. And one of them we rejected, and I forget his name, because he didn't, his operation didn't seem to be big enough to handle what we might give him. I didn't think he had the capacity, enough people around. He was just, mm-hmm. in fact, he had only himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew he couldn't do it. His work was nice, I mean, what he did. Now, you must understand that these people, at that time, designed their own customized cars.
Mm.
And
for individual customers.
Well, yes. In fact, George Barris had a thriving business going there. He's in Hollywood. Well,
mm-hmm.
you've probably heard of George, the king of the customizers.
Mm-hmm.
So he did an awful lot of custom cars for Hollywood personalities. Mm-hmm. And his
he had a Ford connection about this time too, didn't he? Or about 4 or 5 years earlier.
He had a what?
A Ford connection. Bill Schmidt's Futura and the later conversion to the Batmobile.
He, as I understand it, he bought the Futura when it was going to be scrapped, I guess, and mm-hmm. made it into the Batmobile.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't recall much of that, but I do remember the Futura.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that came before or after this, I don't recall either.
I think before. Yeah.
Anyway, mm-hmm. we settled on two of these California customizers with the idea in mind that we would give them a shot. Each had a show car aimed at an auto show, so they had a deadline to work to. And one of them was Gene Winfield, whose outfit was in Modesto, out east of San Francisco. And the other was George Barris, who's in Hollywood. Well,
excuse me, I think the chronology on that was that the Futura came along in the mid-50s, was perhaps retained by Bill Schmidt, and then he sold it to Barris. Is that?
I can't hardly believe that. I mean, that's Ford Motor Company property.
Was it?
Oh, sure.
Well, in any event,
whether or not
someone sold
he could
it to
have,
Barris.
Whether or not he could have bought it when it was going to be scrapped or not, I don't know. I'd lost track of Bill by then.
He'd
gone to Packard, and Packard had folded, and he'd gotten a job at Chrysler with Virgil Exner.
Yes.
But in any case, it was decided that we would give Gene Winfield and George Barris each a crack at doing a show car.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not exact, it was an experiment in part, but it was for real. In other words, they had to perform, they had to execute the cars, not the way they would have done them, but exactly as they had been designed
mm-hmm.
by my group.
Yeah.
And they understood this. And it was an extremely interesting experience, involved a lot of travel. I went out to California about every 2 weeks. I'd go out to San Francisco and then rent a car and drive across the bay over to Modesto and spend a couple of days in there with Gene Winfield. He was doing a Ford,
mm-hmm.
which I named the Constellation.
Oh.
Yeah, no one else would name these things, by the way, so I always named them, and nobody ever questioned them. Oh, yeah, that's the Constellation. Okay. And we sent to George a 1964 Mercury Marauder convertible, which was a prototype. That was another thing that was difficult to get, was the cars to work on, because they weren't really in production then. But this mm-hmm. is the raw car that George got sent to him by the Lincoln Mercury Division. And this is me and Jim Quinlan with the scale drawing that we made as a general guide. We also made detailed drawings of all the parts on the car, like the streamlined headdress and the little air intakes for the carbs and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that and was the basic design rendering that he had to emulate.
This is the code name was Super Marauder.
Yeah.
Had the Marauder been introduced yet in the Mercury line?
No. No, this was actually a prototype vehicle that he got.
Uh-huh.
Well, this shows how we put it, how we fabricated it. George Barris, it's me and some of his guys. And
you would go out and supervise the actual.
Yeah, I did more than that. I had to work on it for a while because they knew they had a deadline, but I got worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a week out there working in the shop. Fortunately, when I was at Fisher Body during the war, I was in the template shop, so I knew how to work metal.
Good.
Mm-hmm. But this shows some of the work that went on. How the car was done. Also shots of the completed car. You can see what we wound up with.
What is the, are those distinctive four apertures on the hood?
They are supposed to be high velocity air intakes for the four barrel carburetor.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Right. We did a special instrument cluster and a steering device other than a steering wheel.
Was Jim Quinlan involved with the instrument clusters in those
days?
Yes,
oh yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's still doing them?
No, not anymore, he isn't.
Oh, isn't he?
No, he's in charge. He's in a trim and color.
That's right. Yes, he's moving on, yeah.
This shows Barris at work on this device on the top here.
How did you find George Barris? A good...
he's fantastic.
Solid craftsman?
Uh-huh. Yeah. There he and I are when the car is in its, one of its rougher stages. Looked pretty rough for a long time.
And that's the finished product.
Yeah.
Fabulous, Dave. Turned out.
And there I am working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a unique glimpse into the customizers.
Yeah.
Studios of those days.
They weren't used to working this close, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They used to doing whatever they want to a car.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's George and I again, doing the unique taillights and so forth. George is quite a character. He's a pure product of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Flamboyant, knows everybody out there, wealthy, parties. I mean, it was quite an experience for me. I got a real exposure to the Hollywood high life, I'll tell you.
Even up in Modesto?
Not so much there. Mm-hmm. That's a quiet place, Modesto.
Up in Marin County?
No, Modesto is out in almost a desert part.
That's east.
It's not north of San Francisco.
Oh, I thought you meant the Golden Gate Bridge.
No, it's across the lower part of the bay. Down,
the Bay Bridge.
Down past the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's out in, it's almost a desert-like area.
But you did get out into Hollywood occasionally, huh?
Well, when I got through with Winfield, I'd head north up, or I'd head south down to Hollywood and work on this one.
Ah.
We had the two of them going at once.
Of course, yes. Winfield was in Modesto. Yeah. Barris was in Hollywood.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Good. Well, how many more of these show cars did you work on after what happened to the Super Marauder?
I don't know.
But it was a concept car for the later introduction of the Mercury Marauder.
Yes, I guess so. My memory doesn't serve me too well as to, I know it went into the auto show circuit, and how many it was to, and what its fate was, I never really followed up on it. I always seem to be busy on something else. You know, you get the job done, and you go to something else.
Yeah. Did you enjoy working on the Super Marauder? That was
yes, I did. The only thing, as I said, in both cases, in the Constellation at Winfield's, the time element got me pretty antsy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I keep reminding these guys that look, you know, the show date's coming up, and it's something we don't postpone. The show goes on whether this car is in it or not, and if it's not in it, I'm going to be in trouble, and you're going to be out of business. No, don't worry, Dave, we'll get it done. So, that was interesting.
It must have been.
Yeah. My career as the fashion trends and special assignments was pretty wild.
Later on, of course, as you well remember, about a decade or so later, they were coming up with fashion designer designs for the Lincoln.
Oh, do I very well know it.
Yeah.
I was involved in that from the day one.
Good. We'll get to that.
Which I'll get to just about at the end of here.
Great.
Long about now came a request from Ford of Germany for a designer to give them a hand on a new program that they didn't seem to think that they were well enough staffed for. They wanted a senior designer type of chap, which is a category of a guy who's a very good designer, and he's had quite a bit of experience, but he's not really into the management area of design yet. I heard about this, and I asked McGuire if I could be considered for that, although I knew I was maybe overtrained for it, as far as in that I was, a couple of notches above what they had asked for. And he says, "Oh, you really want to go to Europe?" I said, "Yeah, I'd like to have some experience there." So we talked it over with Walker, and that's okay with Walker. So without any further ado, I got a passport and went to Germany to work for a summer. In the
this is Ford of Germany in
Cologne,
Taunus Group.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, of course, was a tremendously interesting experience for me because I had never before been abroad. See, we should cut that off.
Dave, let me ask you, what was your assignment in Germany?
Well, as I said, it was a new Taunus, and it had a code name of NXPD. I remember that, but I don't know what it stood for. The exterior clay model was done, and they were just fiddling with some details on it, so I addressed myself to the interior, the instrument panel and the door trim panels and seats, which I largely completed.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the end of the assignment, I was able to bring my wife over, and at the end of the assignment, we had some vacation time, so we spent it on our first driving trip in Europe.
Mm.
Drove down the Rhine and the Rhone and the Mosel and so forth, and Switzerland, and had a grand time.
Mm.
So that was just great.
What was the problem with the Taunus? Was it outdated? Did they want to?
I think it was successful in Europe.
Yes.
It was never successful here, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think it was imported on a limited basis, probably by Lincoln Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it ever achieved anything. It just didn't. I think it would have done well now because it would fit in with today's looks.
Mm-hmm.
You'd say it was ahead of its time,
mm-hmm.
but it was kind of small and pinched looking in a era where American cars were big, wider, longer, lower, mm-hmm. and with lots of chrome hung on them, It just out of joint with its time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I came back from Europe, and the next thing I got put on was a presidential parade car.
What year was this?
Well, what year it was, chronologically, I'm not sure. I know that the base vehicle that we started with was a 61 Lincoln convertible, which was new at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Della Rosa, I believe, was in charge of the exterior part of the car, which is pretty simple. It was about a 10-inch stretch, and there wasn't too much more to it than that. The contract was let out to a ambulance and hearse building firm in Cincinnati named Hess and Eisenhart,
mm-hmm.
Who are very good at that sort of thing. I didn't pick them out. I don't know who did, but whoever did picked the right people out because they knew what they were doing. So I mainly had to do with the interior of the car. So I made a number of trips down there from time to time. I ordered the leather and worked around the special modifications to the car that the Secret Service required.
You worked directly with Hess and Eisenstein?
Yes, Hess and Eisenhart, and also with a chap by the name of Bowman, who was chief of the White House Secret Service staff, mm-hmm. and a very imperious type he was, too.
B-A-U-M-A-N?
B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N, I think it was spelled Bowman. Mm-hmm. He wasn't hard to get along with. He just wanted to be known pretty straight out that, I mean, this was his car, you know. Mm-hmm. He orders the cars, and he has to do with specifying the special equipment that goes in them and whatnot, and the armor and the bulletproof glass and all that sort of stuff.
Was this the Kennedy era?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the car Kennedy was assassinated in.
Ah, good.
I never felt too well about that, but that was out of my control.
I say good because it'd be nice to get the details on that, too.
Well, somewhere along the way in the project, the car was required to have a demountable sort of a roll bar, which was used when the top was down in a parade situation. The president would stand up and could hang on to this, you know, mm-hmm. while the car was moving in a parade. Well, I remember standing in the car with this thing in place, and Bowman was just outside, and I said, isn't this a terribly exposed position for somebody to be standing in? I said, how do you protect the president? He says, don't worry. He says, that's our job. We do that. Mm. Well, ultimately, I guess they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the car was loaded. It was all armor-plated inside and on the floor, and it had bulletproof glass in it and so forth, but here's the president sitting in the back seat, and you know, with nothing behind him. So
there was no plexiglass overlay. Huh?
No, that was the, what was that called? The one that Roosevelt had, the Sunshine Special.
Yes.
Had a bubble top part. But that wouldn't have done much good, I don't think. Plexiglass wouldn't have stopped a high-powered. High-velocity rifle shot. Right. Well, that was an interesting project, and it took me down to Cincinnati a number of times.
Are you aware that the Henry Ford Museum now has that particular vehicle?
Which one?
The one that you designed.
No, I wasn't.
And it was on display for about 3 months in a presidential vehicle exhibit.
I'm pretty sure they had the so-called Sunshine Special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have that too.
No, I didn't know they had that one. There were some little problems involved in working around, you know, compartments that had, you know, armament in them and communications equipment, but everything came out all right.
Mm-hmm.
Except the car failed ultimately. Well, let's see, what does this bring us up to?
When you questioned Bauman about his about the exposed the vulnerability of the passengers, he said, "Don't worry, we'll take care."
Yeah,
of it.
He seemed to be almost offended, like that I would even ask such a question of such a person.
Yes,
he says, "No, don't worry about that." He says, "That's our job. We protect the president."
Mm-hmm.
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, about this time I was back in the Ford studio again.
Mm. Working for him?
Working for Orris.
Joe Orris, huh?
Yes.
O-R-O-S.
O-R-O-S. Damon Woods, who had been there, left to head up the assignment in England.
Mm.
So I replaced Damon.
That was, they were beginning to do that more and more now, are they shifting around? Several executive designers.
Oh, yeah. Well, it became quite prevalent, moved people to England and Germany and Italy to give them broader experience. It's very good, really.
This is the early 60s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say so by then.
Were you one of the first to go to Germany?
No.
In that capacity?
No, Al Muir had been there, and several other guys had been there before me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, back in the Ford studio, and we were busily engaged in doing the 64 Ford, also the Fairlane, the small Ford, and finishing up the 63 Jaguars when the Mustang program came about. I suppose everyone you talk to claims they designed the Mustang.
We would like very much to have your version of it.
Well, you shall have it. About this time, Ford had a program going where they sent various of their managers to a Kepner Trigo management session where you're supposed to learn how to manage by the numbers, as it were. You analyze the you take a problem and you analyze it in about 10 different ways, and it's supposed to all work out, and you come up with the right solution.
Can you spell that for us, Mr. Ash?
Kepner Trigo? Well, it's two names, K-E-P-N-E-R hyphen T-R-E-G-O. I guess it was two guys who originated the program.
Thank you. Where was that located?
Anyway, well, number of places. Okay. What they did was you became part of a group of Ford managers, some from the design center, some from Lincoln Mercury, some from engineering, you know, various parts of the company. Mm-hmm. In this case, you went to the St. Clair Inn for a week. You went away, and you were there, and you got these sessions in the morning and in the afternoon, and I think after dinner. And you're allowed to have happy hour in between and so forth, but it was a pretty confined, pretty regulated, intensive. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Joe was sent to this thing just as the Mustang broke. Well, leading up to the Mustang was a whole series of exploratory models called, variously called Allegro, and I don't know, they're all in this book. They were all done in the Advanced Studio under Della Rosa's direction. Mm-hmm. There was a whole raft of them. Mm-hmm. They were all done mostly on the same general package size. And I think the company was serious about producing such a car. And as far as I know, it was Iacocca's special idea that this happened. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much time was spent, probably at least a year, and I think maybe as many as 10 or 11 separate models were developed in full-size clay in Della Rosa's studio. Mm-hmm. Some had minor variations in package and so forth, but essentially it was a small, sporty car.
When you say package, that indicates that there has been some preliminary discussions, fairly high level, and some decisions have been made to the general shape and form.
Of course, I was not privy to any of these. I wasn't involved at all. I was doing other things at the time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I think, the sequence of events was that eventually one of these was liked enough that it was taken to the styling committee for approval.
Now, who would be on the styling committee?
Well, it's Henry Ford. Would have been Henry Ford. And who's the chairman? I don't know who the president of the company was at that time. R.J. Miller, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Although he was only president for
McNamara. R.J. went into the
60s. Yeah, probably McNamara. And Bordenay by that time was the vice president. Mm-hmm. And a number of other people, old Lundy, I suppose, a lot of them really with no ability to judge style, but they had the rank. And of course, the vice president, general manager of the divisions, especially the one that was involved in this case was Iacocca.
Mm-hmm.
I was not at that styling committee meeting, but what must have happened there was that, yeah, Lee, it's a good idea, but what else have we got to look at? You know, they had one model in front of them. Are you about to out of
no.
tape? I'm surmising that this is what happened because that's how I got involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the other studios got involved in it. So, sort of like that afternoon or early the next morning, Gene called into his office, Buzz Grissinger and Della Rosa, and he would have, I guess maybe McGuire too. And he would have called Joe, except that Joe was out at the St. Clair Inn.
Mm.
So he called me in.
Mm-hmm.
And he outlined what was to be done. He says, you got 2 weeks. And you're going to have to come up with an alternative proposal to, what was in the show this morning or yesterday, whenever it was. And you'll be given the package that you cannot deviate from.
Mm-hmm.
And good luck.